Welcome to Observations, a program that is designed to introduce those of you who do not yet know God to Him. A program designed for those who know Him so that they might know Him better. This program, Observations, is designed to share the way to God. Not only explain why He created the universe and authored life, but to share with you what He wants. Observations is designed to communicate from God's perspective how He has communicated with us so that we know precisely what He's offering. Also that you might know how to capitalize on His offer. And this program is designed to present history, past, present, and future, all from the perspective of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, from the perspective of God, so that we might know man's history from his time in the garden to his ultimate celebration of 1,000 years of living on this planet, with the entire planet transformed into the Garden of Eden, those kinds of conditions, living, camping out with God, to an eternity where we will witness the birth of a new universe, this one with us as participants. We have four individuals that will be contributing to this program, more if they wish to over time. These four individuals, none of which were chosen. If you wonder why, you know, this cast of characters was assembled, it was because we volunteered. If somebody else wishes to contribute that understands the Torah, that knows Yahweh, that is a member of the covenant, then they are welcome to join us. And as for me, my name is Craig. We have Scott. Scott was the program director of Shattering Mist, the program that we concluded not so long ago on Genesis Communication Radio Network. We can, for those of you who would like to listen to those programs, they're archived at the site blessyahweh.com. Hello, Scott.
Hello. Good to see you again, or hear you again, or whatever this would be.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also have Kirk. Kirk was morning, Kirk, regular contributor to the Shattering Mist program during its last several months on the air, and sometime during this program we expect to hear from Larry, who is the most regular contributor to the Yada Yah Shabbat program that we do on the Torah once a week on Blog Talk Radio, and Larry will be joining us shortly. I want to begin with a bit of news, Scott, if that's all right with you.
Kirk.
I read a story this morning. The world now has its first Sharia-compliant airlines. In Malaysia, they've launched an airline that is wholly Sharia-compliant. They will be serving halal food. Have you ever heard the name halal used by, you know what it means, what it is, what it represents?
It's the first name of, or the first part of the name of Hasatan.
Halal bin Shakar, right?
Halal bin Shakar. Satan is only presented by name twice in the entire Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It's both in the book of Yeshayah, Isaiah, and there he is introduced as an emissary of Babylon, as someone who wants to be worshipped as God, not as the adversary, as someone who is above God. Allahu Akbar should scream into your mind at this point, as the only known wannabe deity that wants to be worshipped as God and seen above God. And Hasatan, the adversary, which is not a name but a descriptive title, is named Halal bin Shakar. And so on this Sharia-compliant airline, they will be serving Satan's food, named after Satan, halal. But beyond that, it will also be fully Sharia-compliant. Do you guys know the basis of Sharia law?
Pretty much.
not well enough to give an answer, but I know I know that it's not very very friendly. The Quran, right?
No. Sharia law is probably 5% based on the Quran. 95% of Sharia law is based upon the words and deeds of Muhammad. And the words and deeds of Muhammad are chronicled in the Hadith. There are four collections of Hadith comprised of Muhammad's words and deeds written within 200 years of his death. Ishaq compiled the first collection of Hadith in his Sirah, or biography. Tabari also wrote a chronological presentation of what Muhammad said and did, and what happened immediately upon Muhammad's death in his history, or Tariq. And then there are two topical collections of Hadith, the same Hadith, but arranged by topic as opposed to chronological order, one by Muslim, one by Bukhari. They comprise 100%, along with the 5% that comes with from the Quran, of Sharia. And so it's based entirely on Muhammad's words and deeds. But Muhammad was a thief. He was a pirate. He was a slave trader. He was a kidnapper. He was a pedophile. He was a rapist. He was a liar. He was amongst the most perverted, disgusting, murderous individuals who ever lived. He said of himself, "I have become victorious with terror." And so, in a Sharia-compliant aircraft, what we would have is someone mirroring Muhammad's behavior. So, welcome. Board the aircraft, and you are encouraged to rape the stewardesses. You're encouraged to have sex with other passengers' children. You can even have sex with your pet goat if you brought a goat on board the aircraft. You are encouraged to kill anyone who isn't a Muslim. And, of course, you are entitled to enslave them and rob them. Can you imagine the experience on a Sharia-compliant airline?
Fly the friendly skies.
Fly the friendly skies of Hasatan.
And I was just sitting here thinking about a joke about the landing.
Well, yeah, the landing is designed by Muslims, and therefore will fly into buildings to kill as many infidels as possible while screaming Allahu Akbar. So I thought that was spectacular news that yes, indeed, the world now has a Sharia-compliant airline. Don't think I will be flying it anytime soon.
No.
Add that to the list of things that we have that we did not need.
No. One of my favorite people, Jackie, who was the principal editor for each of the books that I've written, the composite volumes of Yada Ya, Intro to God, and Questioning Paul, she sent me an email that has come from a healthcare worker, a physician, I believe, if not a physician, then a nurse practitioner in Germany, speaking of the million Muslims who have entered Germany. And her assessment is, and having encountered them, because he said the very high percentage of them are seriously ill, is that, she describes them as animals. She says that they are sick with diseases that they don't even know how to treat. And in European hospitals, diseases that Europe and America rid themselves of through sanitation and through proper hygiene, a century ago. And that they're extraordinarily aggressive, demeaning towards women. If a woman tries to treat them, they absolutely refuse. Their children are often very sick, and if they try to charge them for their child's medicine, even a fraction of the cost, they'll say, "You keep the kid. You fix him. It's yours." That they will, if they do not like the way they have been treated, if they think that that they're not receiving the best that you can offer absolutely free, because as Muslims, she says that they view themselves as vastly superior to all others, they're viciously stabbing healthcare workers. But they're communicating diseases and an attitude that is extraordinarily hostile, where this healthcare worker says, it isn't worth it. I've devoted my life to this, but I'm going to move to another country. I'm going to begin to practice medicine elsewhere because this is miserable.
I read that email. It was horrible.
Yeah.
It was absolutely horrible.
Yeah, and they say that just like America, you can't have an honest discussion about the problem. Now, she says none of these people are properly trained. She says you couldn't put any of them to work.
Mm-hmm.
They're very poorly educated. The women are not educated at all. The women have no interest whatsoever in working, and the men are ill-equipped to work. And they think that they're entitled to everything, housing, medical care, pensions, food. Just think of the burden. You've got a group of people who are angry, who think that they're superior, who are contributing nothing and are wholly disruptive to the system as it currently is, and they have brought in already a million of them. We predicted this would happen.
They'll never recover from the diseases.
No.
I'm telling you, it's the pestilence.
No, all religions are diseased.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as it comes to Islam, I think I know and understand the religion as well as anybody alive. And so I'm in a position to be extraordinarily judgmental of Islam and judgmental of the stupidity of Europe of accepting these refugees and not of dealing with Islam appropriately. And I'm telling you that it is inhumane. This very notion of the elitist thinking that it is compassionate to welcome the refugees and to bring them into one's country. I'm saying, no, it's exactly the opposite. It is incredibly hostile. It is incredibly immoral. Because what they're going to do is they're going to do as Sharia dictates. They're going to do as Muhammad did. All of them know. Many of the Muslims coming in are lousy Muslims. They've got no idea who Muhammad was. They have no idea what the Quran says. They have no idea of any aspect of their religion. It's like, you know, most nominal Christians are clueless as to what their religion actually says. But there's a significant portion of them. In most Islamic countries, it's about 60% that are actually good Muslims. And therefore, they know that Muhammad was a terrorist. They know the meaning of jihad. They know what is expected, in fact, demanded of them. And they will be as Muhammad was. They will be rapists. They will be pedophiles. They will engage in bestiality. They will rob. They will kill. They will terrorize. Because Muhammad did all of these things, and all of these things are not only sanctioned in Islam, but required by the religion. So, bringing that into your home isn't merciful, it isn't moral, it isn't reasonable. It is the antithesis of those things. It isn't compassionate. You know, when I looked at the list of people who were killed in San Bernardino, by the two Muslims that were allowed to practice their religion, the woman who was the ringleader actually being brought into this country. To say that it was merciful, to say that it was compassionate, to say that it was good or moral or wise, to allow her to come in. When she and her husband took the life of so many innocent people, then you have lost the ability to be reasonable.
Well, apparently we have. They keep doing it. I mean, the newspapers are full of it. The television news is that way. They all take a position.
Right. And just like the situation in Germany, as this writer of this email says, you can't tell the truth. The media has zero appetite for it. They will not allow any discussion that brings up the harm. And what they are constantly doing is the media now, every day, there's multiple stories in every major media outlet of some Muslim family that is expressing their appreciation for being brought in and how they fled Islamic terrorism. And, you know, you can find those stories. And those stories are the ones that are being presented. But what's not being presented is the reality that what happened in Paris is a direct result of the immigration of Muslims into the continent. And to tell that story, to explain the actual nature of Islam, to share with people that there is no such thing as an extremist or radical Muslim, that there is no radical or extremist Quran, that it is what it is. Period. There's only one Muhammad, only one Quran, only one group of hadith that have any credibility. There's only one Sharia. There aren't variations of Islam.
Well, they've even told us that. Erdogan said it. He said there's no...
Islam.
Radical.
There is Islam. That's it.
Right. No, there's just Islam. There's just Islam. And the Islam of terror is the purest form of the religion. It's not a corruption of the religion. It's not a radicalization of the religion. It's not an extremist interpretation of the religion. It is the religion. Islam was founded as a criminal enterprise, and it grew based on terror. And all you have to do is read the Quran. Read the 8th surah of the Quran, which explains that Muhammad's first terrorist act was armed robbery, and that he did it specifically because he wanted to rob his neighbors, and that he was murderous, and he was sadistic in the process, and that he engaged in kidnap. This is the nature of Islam. It was born as a criminal enterprise, and it grew through terrorism. Now, I don't want to pick solely on Islam, because we are bringing you this first program of observations on what the world would call Christmas Eve. I drove by my neighbor's house in the front lawn. There's two billboards in the front lawn. And it says in bold letters, all caps, Christ-Mass, God's gift to the world. You know what that does to me when I see that?
It should make you sick.
It does. Turns my gut. Makes me want to puke. Then it makes me want to say, what in the hell is wrong with you? And, of course, it sits across from a little rock church on the road, on the highway. Let's speak a little bit about this and why this person is so deceived. Let's begin with the notion that Christmas is the celebration of God's birthday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this
was God born?
No.
Can God die?
He's Hayah.
Yeah, he is Hayah, which the verb introduces himself to Moshe by nature before he introduces himself to Moshe by name. And what we find is that the verb that he used to describe his nature is the basis of his name. So Yahweh says, I am who I am. It's Ihaya, which is says that I exist. I was. I am. I will be. Matter of fact, when I began this program, I said we're going to talk about history, past, present, and future, the history of man, past, present, and future. And that is because from Yahweh's perspective as Haya, as one who was, is, and always will be, history plays out the same way. The same way as the verb Haya that you just mentioned, Kirk.
Yes.
And in Hebrew, verbs do not get stuck in time like they are in English. In English, we have past, present, and future, and variations of past, present, and future. There is no such thing in Hebrew. So, in Hebrew, a verb comprises all time. It is true then, as it is now, as it is true, as it will be true in the future. And Yahweh says that he is Haya, and his name, Yahweh, is based on the verb Haya, which means to exist, past, present, and future. Therefore, God cannot be born. So the very nature of Christmas is a bogus concept, as is the basis of Christianity, that God died for your sins. God cannot die.
No.
And so you're celebrating an event that is preposterous. And you're ascribing a preposterous event to God. And even the notion, God's gift to the world, wait a minute. If it was God that was born, then how is it God's gift to the world? Who in the hell is God that is giving the child if the child is God? Huh? I mean, think it through, people. Now, beyond the fact that there is no birth of God, does God ever mention a holiday called Christmas?
Never.
Does God ever have a holiday associated with the winter solstice?
Never.
Do the Babylonians have, and the Romans and the Greeks, did they have a holiday associated with Christmas?
Indeed they do.
And did they celebrate the winter solstice?
They certainly did.
What did Yahweh say about the religious ways and the political ways of the Gentiles?
He said, avoid them like the plague.
That's right. He did, didn't he? So, folks, there is no mention of anything even remotely akin to Christmas. And the Torah, prophets, and Psalms are even in your Christian New Testament. It is a Babylonian pagan holiday associated with man's invention of false gods.
Because now, we can do it better, right?
Right. So when Yosha, which was the actual name, there was no one ever named Christ. Christ isn't even a name, and it means it's based on the Greek word chrysos, which means to be drugged. And he wasn't a Greek, which means he did not have a Greek title, much less a Greek name. His name was actually Yosha. What does that mean, Scott?
Yahweh saves.
That's what it means. So here we have Yosha. You know what day that Yosha arrived?
Well, I'm sure it was Yom Kippurim.
Nope.
Would have come in the fall.
Nope. It wasn't yet close with Yom Kippurim, but not exactly.
Sukkah?
Absolutely. What does Sukkah mean?
Sukkah is to walk with God.
Camp out with God, right? Sukkah means to camp out. So it's to camp out with God. So man camping out with God is the celebration of Sukkah. He arrived on Sukkah. When what is another name? It's in fact the apostle Yohanan, corrupted to John. Introduces him in terms of his arrival in association with something called tabernacles. That's from the translated via the Greek. Is there a connection between tabernacles and Sukkah?
Well, it is. Tabernacles is Sukkah.
Yeah. Sukkah speaks of a tent, one that you would use for a temporary shelter or home. And it is the tent of the witness, for example, is called the tabernacle. Tabernacles is just another name for Sukkah.
Mm-hmm.
So he told us that he arrived on Sukkah. So if you're going to celebrate a date associated with Yosha's arrival, you would have to celebrate what date?
Sukkah.
Does Sukkah ever coincide with the winter solstice?
Could not happen.
No, never. Impossible. Because isn't Sukkah the 15th day of the 7th month?
Yes, sir.
And doesn't the calendar begin right around the vernal equinox with the renewal of the moon's light closest to the vernal equinox?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's impossible. But okay. That's when the Romans celebrated the birth of the Son of the Sun. So when the Greeks celebrated the birth of the Sun, because in all of these religions, Mother Earth was impregnated, the Mother of God, Queen of Heaven, impregnated by the Sun on the vernal equinox, on the spring equinox, when the Sun is in the constellation of Taurus the Bull, and 9 months later, on the winter solstice?
Baby Jesus.
There you go. So, moron that has the placard out in front of their home. The gift that is given by Christmas is the gift of the false gods of the Babylonians, of the Greeks, and of the Romans.
Wherever it spread, Saturn.
Yeah, nothing but paganism is what you are spreading in that regard. If you wanted to celebrate his arrival, it would be celebrating it on Sukkah and understanding what it means to be able to camp out with God. Now, going beyond that, was it God that was given to humanity as a baby? Was Paul right in that the fullness of the Godhead arrived?
No. Child is born.
In fact, would that be possible?
No.
Not for us to still be able to be here.
Right. In fact, Yahweh is a seven-dimensional construct, and all of seven dimensions does not fit into three and a half dimensions.
No.
And if all of God was in that baby, you wouldn't have much of a God, would you?
No.
I mean, it is absolutely preposterous. And why would Yahusha constantly say the Father is greater than I? Why would he say refer people to the Father if in fact he was the totality of God? Who in the hell is the Father if in fact Yahusha is the totality of God?
Mm-hmm. Absurd notion.
Yeah, it's an absurd notion. And so Paul was wrong, and Christianity's focus on, even if they knew his name,
mm-hmm.
even if they knew that he arrived on Sukkah, even if they knew that he fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah, and understood what those dates meant, and that that's why he arrived, even if they knew that he was the living embodiment of the Torah, even if they understood that he was a diminished, twice diminished manifestation of Yahweh, twice diminished, and that you're setting apart part of Yahweh, you know, no more than by reference a toenail clipping from an individual, setting apart a part of Yahweh into our world and transitioning that part from spiritual energy to matter, to a physical being, which requires a diminishment at the rate of the speed of light times the speed of light.
Yeah.
So all you have is a tiny,
infinite,
microscopic representation of who God is. Why would you pay homage to? Why would you focus on a tiny representation of who Yahweh is when you can know Yahweh as he is and develop a relationship with the totality of Yahweh? So this idea that Christ was God's gift to the world is preposterous. Not only was he not Greek, not only was he not drugged, the basis of Christo, not only wasn't that his name and isn't a name, but he's just a tiny representation of Yahweh. It's Yahweh, a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, providing us with a means not only of seeing and observing the Torah manifest in our world and how to properly observe the Torah, but also to fulfill the first four
Mikra.
Moed Mikra, the invitations in the Torah. Why the first four, and when did he do it? So we're now dealing with Yahusha's arrival. When did he, in the broad spectrum of history, when did he fulfill the first four Moed Mikra?
In 33 CE, of course, but it's the Passover or Pesach.
Uh-huh.
The week of Matzah covers that, then Bukurim, and then later.
Yeah. Is 33 CE a relevant number for Yahweh, or does it equate to one?
That's on a Gregorian calendar.
Yeah. It's year 4000 Yah, communicated via the Gregorian or Roman calendar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Rome, Yahweh calls Rome the greatest beast that has ever menaced humankind. And he's speaking not only of the empire of Rome, but also of the Roman Catholic Church, and therefore of Christianity, as the most dangerous beast, the most vicious beast that has ever menaced humankind.
Right,
so when you use 33, be aware that you're using the beast's calendar. And so, yes, he was the greater light, shown as a sign for these meeting times, just as it was predicted, and the fourth day of creation, where it said the greater light will become a sign of the Moed.